Trendstorm.
Our final topic, picked by you, dear listeners, earlier in a poll on our Facebook page, is North Korea and the U.S. Who's really provoking whom? Focusing on the ever-tense situation in the Korean Peninsula. In response to North Korea's latest missile test, the U.S. and South Korea conducted live fire bombing exercises along the DMZ, making one wonder who's really provoking whom. The Pentagon, as it's always wont to do, intended for the drills to be a show of force in deterring what they believed to be Pyongyang's aggression. Though North Korea understandably interpreted this as an unprecedented escalation of the crisis intended to intimidate it into concessions. What makes this latest episode even more interesting is that the U.S. conducted the drills under the pretense that North Korea had tested its first intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM, which its mainstream media outlets fear-mongered could hit Hawaii and Alaska. Though Russia and even South Korea both claim for different reasons that this isn't exactly the case. Moscow alleges to have evidence that the missile which North Korea just tested is an intermediate-range one and not an ICBM, while Seoul came out and said that it doesn't believe that Pyongyang has ICBM re-entry technology. In other words, the U.S. is overhyping the extent of the supposed threat posed by North Korea, possibly in order to justify its controversial THAAD deployment in South Korea. This anti-missile system has become an inseparable part of the Korean crisis since it's directly linked to the North's missile test, though it's thought by some to be more directed towards neutralizing Russia and China's nuclear second strike capabilities than North Korea's first strike ones. It's partially because of THAAD that both Eurasian great powers suggested a joint course of action in resolving this problem during President Xi's visit to Moscow, proposing that North Korea halt its missile test in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea freezing their large-scale and provocative military drills. That still doesn't directly deal with the threat that Moscow and Beijing feel is posed by THAAD, though it could create the conditions for Seoul's new pragmatic president to argue that the installations are no longer needed. In any case, an objective overview of the situation leads one to question the mainstream media narrative that North Korea is the only provocative actor in Northeast Asia, since there are more than enough grounds to solidly argue that the U.S. is playing a similarly destabilizing role as well. Alrighty, folks, so to start off our discussion today, we are joined by Mr. Hanuel Naavi. He's a contributing writer on political economy and geopolitics for The Duran. Hi, Hanuel.
Trendstorm.
How proportionate of a response was it that the U.S. and South Korea commenced live-fire military exercises close to the DMZ following North Korea's latest missile test?
Well, the exercises that you're talking about are related to the Fall Eagle exercises, which are annual exercises which have taken place since 1997, and they normally occur around March to late April. And so it was actually the same size as the exercise that was last year in 2016. And this occurred under Obama as he was leaving office, not necessarily under Trump. Now, what I would like to say is that it's more important to understand why do you think that these drills are necessary? Why does the U.S. think that they're necessary? And what it does is it signifies that Washington is losing power in the Asia Pacific. And this is coming because of the rejection of the THAAD anti-missile defense system, which is has been scrapped by Moon Jae-in.
Okay, well, the next thing I want to ask you is about the differing interpretations over what North Korea actually did test, because Russia says that North Korea didn't test an ICBM, and South Korea claims that the North doesn't have ICBM reentry technology, though many voices in the mainstream media say that North Korea can now directly threat in Alaska, Hawaii, and maybe even soon California, too. So what's behind this narrative disconnect, and what do you think North Korea's missile capabilities truly are?
Well, the Russians are right in this. They didn't use an ICBM. And again, this is to justify the U.S. THAAD system being deployed in South Korea. Now, firstly, America is in the business of selling arms, maintaining regional control of resources. So they want to use things like THAAD, F-35s, Abrams tanks, howitzers. And this is a kind of advertising that they use to maintain this constant flow of arms sales. Now, going into the actual logistics of the matter, we look at why it's not an ICBM. So what it is purported that it was actually a KN-17, which is a short-range ballistic missile. possibly a Hwasong-12, which is an intermediate range ballistic missile. And we look at some of the analysis that has actually come out of the media. We have the London Guardian, which quoted one scientist saying that analysts by Japan and South Korea supported the account given by North Korea's Academy of Defense Sciences, which said that missiles traveled an altitude of 1,741 miles and flew 580 miles. But in order to qualify for an ICBM, you have to travel 3,500 miles. So it doesn't have the capability to actually reach the shores of the United States on the Pacific end. Now, another thing, another analyst actually talked about in Reuters recently is that considering how North Korea does not have any testing facilities for re-entry technology, that it's almost improbable, if not impossible, that they would be able to secure that kind of technology. This was a quote directly from Yi Wang-young.
All righty, Hanwell. And for the last thing I want to talk to you about today is I want to find out how you assess the overall significance of the joint Russian-Chinese position on North Korea and whether you think there's a likelihood that their de-escalation proposal will be listened to by either side.
Well, as far as North Korea goes, you know, North Korea has been kind of doing provocations ever since they did the armistice in 1953. So essentially, you know, it's been a perpetual state of warfare. They haven't even signed a peace treaty. It's an armistice. That means that they have agreed to stop fighting. Now, as far as Russia and China's role in there, it's Russia and China's backyard. And China especially doesn't want an influx of migrants going into the Liaoning province, which is in the northeast near nearby Xinjiang. Now, they've also got in the UNSC, in the UNGA, they've got pragmatic priorities at this moment. And the United States is doing its best to focus on the Asia-Pacific region after losing its front in Syria. So it's trying to shift its priorities to the Asia-Pacific. Currently, you know, that Russia and China want to focus on the One Belt, One Road. And this is going to involve all of the Asian continent, including Europe and the Middle East. And so America is doing its best to destabilize this by keeping its footing within the South China Sea region and keeping itself constantly focused on North Korea's actions, which have not really changed over the last few years. The most provocative thing that has occurred at this time was the Yongpyeong Island shelling, which happened in 2010, and that was about as bad as it got. But testing these nukes and missiles and things like that, that's just to justify $1.25 billion being spent on one THAAD missile defense system. And it's going to cost them a lot. Moon Jae-in doesn't want it. The Chinese doesn't want it. And neither do the Russians.
Hanwell, thank you very much for joining us. And I hope that we'll have you on again sometime in the future. Thanks for your analysis.
Trendstorm.
Now we're going to move over and see what Mr. Edwin Chen has to say about this. He's an activist focusing on the Asian Holocaust of World War II. Hello, Edwin. Okay, what I want to ask you about are the difference in approaches coming from Russia and China on one hand and the U.S. on the other, as the first two seem to be applying a combination of carrots and sticks through sanctions and dialogue, while the last one, Washington, is concentrating much more fully on military pressure. So what's your take on the difference between these two?
There are stark differences in approaches to the Korean Peninsula crisis. Russia and China, they don't really seem to have much leverage against the DPRK, short of more sanctions that would actually further starve more North Koreans and hence lower the quality of living. As large nuclear powers themselves, they don't wish for more nuclear proliferation, but they feel no obligation to their American rival to actually pressure a key scapegoat that clearly takes a lot of pressure off of China and Russia from a long-term strategic view. Many military analysts are in consensus over the opinion that Russia and China will become the main focus of U.S. military containment strategies if smaller enemies in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Africa, and the TPRK were castrated, subdued, or mitigated. For China and Russia, the TPRK survival as an American thorn eases some pressure on. So fundamentally, there's a lack of powerful and pragmatic incentives for Russia and China to view the TPRK through the same hostile lens that the Americans do. The United States, China, and Russia collectively have no real ability to end QK in the TPRK. Even if China starved off the North Korean populace, her people would not give in to a former colonizer. advisor.
Okay, well, this is what I want to ask you then, Edwin. For just to wrap up, we got about a minute left. Where do you see the Korean crisis headed then? I mean, you already explained how the approach by Russia and China is limited in pressuring or coercing North Korea, whereas, you know, the U.S., I mean, that approach is dead on arrival. It's military aggression, and it would lead to a disaster for everybody. So where do you see the Korean crisis headed then in that case? What's your prognosis?
We have reached a point of attrition on the Korean Peninsula at this point. The U.S. is currently military and politically powerless to seriously attack a nuclear TPRK. Even without thermonuclear weapons, the TPRK cannot easily attack without facing the destruction of the ROK capital of Seoul. It is too close to the TPRK's conventional artillery to escape retribution if the U.S. were to attack it. The reason this is an important crux for both the ROK and the U.S. is not just because of politics, but the pure logistical fact that in a small country such as the ROK, the highly populated, educated, industrious, and innovative capital actually makes up half of the total population. Major losses of Seoul would cripple the ROK, which is a major linchpin relative to its size in the interconnected and globalized world. In the future, I see more posturing by the U.S. and defiance from the TPRK. China might cooperate with the U.S. on a limited and insignificant scale in terms of sanctions against the TPRK if coaxed, coerced, or pressured enough. However, I don't really feel they will do anything that seriously changes the status quo against their own interests, which partially include an independent and defiant TPRK thorn in America's side. Now, as for Russia, I don't think they will do anything to help the U.S. against the TPRK because of the present state of animosity and hostility between the two nations, especially now that American national security agencies directly accused Russia of intervening in our internal affairs and last presidential election.
Edwin, thank you. This is a very passionate interview, and I really appreciate your enthusiasm and telling us all about what's happening in Northeast Asia. Thank you very much.
Trendstorm.
Now, folks, if we think back on what Haniel and Edwin both told us today during our program, I think we can come to the conclusion that things aren't as black and white as the mainstream media makes them appear. There is a huge historical context being left out of North Korea's relations with the U.S. That's first and foremost. And secondly, though, we see that the tit-for-tat measures that the U.S. believes it's implementing towards North Korea are in many ways actually upping the ante and making this crisis even more destabilizing. Because North Korea is somewhat unpredictable, but at the same time, so too are the U.S.'s military responses. Now, folks, if you want to sound off and share what you think about this very interesting topic, please send us an email at radio@sputniknews.com or find us on Facebook. And with this, we end this week's edition of Trendstorm, brought to you by Radio Sputnik. It was presented by me, Andrew Kripko. Thank you for listening, and take care.